It's Central Time. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Cold War might have been focused on Washington and Moscow, but Wisconsin played a role, and some of the evidence is still visible today.
First, while Christmas might be over, the holiday season is still in full swing. Families are gathering, parties are happening, and New Year's is right around the corner. And while we have all of our own holiday traditions, it's worth remembering that presidents aren't immune from all the holiday fun either.
Thanks to the nature of their job, our commanders-in-chief celebrate the holidays in very unique ways. Some presidential holiday traditions have grown over time, while others have been particular to the individual office holders. Today, we thought we'd step back from our own celebrations to take a peek into this unique slice of presidential life.
Kenneth C. Davis joins us now. He's an historian and the author of Don't Know Much About History and other books in the Don't Know Much About series. His latest book is More Deadly Than War, The Hidden History of the Spanish Flu and the First World War. Ken, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon. A great pleasure to be with you, and happy second day of Christmas, I kind of think. There's a debate over this.
Is that like second cousins? Nobody's quite sure, or once removed, which is which?
Sort of like that. Obviously, I'm referring to the 12 days of Christmas, my least favorite Christmas carol. I don't know about you, but a lot of people wonder if it starts, many people thought it's the 12 days leading up to Christmas, but it's actually the 12 days from Christmas to the Epiphany, January 6th.
Right.
And there's a debate over whether it starts on Christmas Day or if the 26th is the first day of Christmas. So I don't know if you should be sending out the turtle dove or the partridge in the pear tree today.
Ken, it is Boxing Day, right?
It is absolutely Boxing Day. We're sure about that because we all went back to the stores today with our boxes and returns of the things. No, Boxing Day refers back to, it may even date as far back as medieval times, and it was essentially the idea that, especially in England, this was the day that the feudal peasants got a gift for Christmas. That they would get a box from the lords and the ladies, all those lords and ladies dancing. So the idea was that if you were in service, and this certainly continued well into the 18th and 19th century, if you were in service, you worked on Christmas Day, and the day after Christmas was your day off, and that would be the day that the boss, the lords or whoever it was, would give you a box with your Christmas gift, maybe perhaps some money or something small. So that's the Boxing Day tradition. In Ireland, it's more typically celebrated as St. Stephen's Day, St. Stephen being the first saint, and it is his feast day. So that's more typically, and some other Catholic countries celebrate St. Stephen's Day. So the day after Christmas has meaning, different meanings to different people all over the world.
So we are a former British colony, and I think of this as a British celebration in Great Britain and in former colonies. It tends to be, Boxing Day tends to be a thing. Why do you think it's never caught on here?
I guess it has to do with the fact that we did declare our independence fairly early on and didn't have the same sense of the aristocracy. And that would be the only guess I can come up with for why it didn't catch on. So many American Christmas traditions, by the way, really didn't take hold until well into the 19th century. Also, you have to remember that this was a very, very Puritan country for a very long time. And it was the Puritans who, in 1659, banned Christmas. That is correct. Christmas was not allowed to be celebrated in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and you would be fined shillings for any kind of merriment. And that was true in England as well under Cromwell. The Puritans believed that this date of December 25th and all of the festivities that went along with it were a vestige of paganism, had nothing to do with the Bible, and therefore should not be celebrated. So there wasn't really a true official recognition of Christmas in this country for a very long time. It only became a national holiday in 1870 after the Civil War. So it's interesting to think that we think of, oh, this is a Christian country, but the Puritans certainly didn't like Christmas, and they didn't, you know, they were a festive bunch, those people who gave us the Salem witch trials. But it is the fact that so many of the things that we celebrate as Christmas traditions are pre-Christian pagan traditions that got carried over into Christian times, everything from the Christmas tree and the mistletoe to the holly.
Well, Kenneth, we're talking about Christmas, and to that end, what do we know about how some of our early presidents celebrated the holidays?
Well, the first one that comes to mind right off the bat, and since we mentioned the colonies, I should mention the very, very significant Christmas Day in American history was 1776, when George Washington thought it would be a good idea to launch a sneak attack in the middle of the early hours of the night after Christmas, actually, on the Hessians in Trenton, New Jersey. And so it was Christmas night when we see him crossing the Delaware, not in that boat as depicted most, you know, widely, and that's a very much of an idealized image of Washington crossing the Delaware. It certainly didn't look anything like that. But it was a Christmas attack. And certainly the Hessians, who are Germans, were probably sleeping and probably had a Tannenbaum, because the Tannenbaum, the fir tree, was really a German tradition. You were saying a lot of the, we think of a lot of Christmas traditions as English, but the English really get a lot of their Christmas traditions from the Germans, and the Christmas tree is certainly one of them. And so when we think about those sleeping Hessian soldiers on Christmas morning, they were probably sleeping around a Tannenbaum, a Christmas tree. It gives a little different flavor to the story of the Revolution. The first Christmas tree in the White House is William Henry Harrison, who comes along. And this is an indication of how late it was that Christmas really starts to get the official recognition that we would take for granted today. It was not until 1891 that there was a Christmas tree in the White House. And in fact, President Harrison, we don't think of him as a rather jolly fellow in too many ways, but he actually dressed as Santa Claus and performed beside the White House Christmas tree in what was then a library, later the Oval Office, for his grandchildren and their friends. You know, there's not really too much reference to Christmases in the White House before then, and I think that is partially a reflection of this long-held Puritan Protestant ethic about, you know, how to properly celebrate the birth of the Lord.
We're talking with historian Ken Davis right now about the Christmas and holiday traditions in the White House and by the residents of the White House over the years. And Ken, the White House Historical Association has tracked where the Blue Room Christmas trees have been coming from since 1961, and eight of those trees, putting us in third place, have come from Wisconsin. So I'm thinking this is something we should be feeling pretty good about here.
Absolutely, you have great pride of place. I assume none of them was red, but that's a different story. Seems like the red Christmas trees created some controversy this year. I don't know. Everyone likes their Christmas colors as they should be. So another interesting one that I've come across is you would think that December of 1941 wouldn't be too festive, you know, we just weeks after the attack on Pearl Harbor. And in fact, it wasn't that it wasn't festive so much as that they were really concerned about Christmas lights in Washington, D.C., right after Pearl Harbor. And Secret Service really wanted FDR not to light the Christmas tree. And I think that FDR ended up kind of getting his own way. So they did have a Christmas tree, but there was a blackout in Washington, D.C. in that time. We forget sometimes, we take for granted what America was like at different times, but blackouts were part of the routine American life in the early months, late months of 1941 and going into 1942. And then rationing took over. But Roosevelt certainly wanted to have a Christmas tree, and he wanted, in fact, I think that Churchill was there as well. It must have been quite a Christmas. Imagine Roosevelt and Churchill gathered together for Christmas in the White House.
Kenneth, what about Christmas cards? If you go to WhiteHouseChristmasCards.com, which has more information you can imagine about what each president wrote in their Christmas cards, what can you tell us about this tradition?
That one, you've got me there. I'm sure the White House Historical Society can fill that in. I think what's kind of interesting with Christmas cards is how they've become, like everything else, politicized in a way. I mean, the politicization of Christmas, this idea of a war on Christmas, has really been something that came up in the last 10 years or so, I would say, became a conservative talk radio talking point in some respects, that some presidents were not saying Merry Christmas, they were saying Happy Holidays, which was not the case in most cases, and they still call it the White House Christmas tree. And this has been part of a deterioration, I guess, in just America's civil discourse, and so we can't even celebrate Christmas properly. But that reminds me of the fact that, speaking of Franklin D. Roosevelt, Roosevelt once had changed the date of Thanksgiving. It was before the war. It was in 1939, I think, and the merchants came to him. The presidential holiday proclamation for Thanksgiving, because it wasn't truly a federal holiday yet in 1939, was scheduled for the last week in November, which is where Lincoln had placed it first back in 1863. Roosevelt was asked by the merchants of the country to move it up a week to the third week, because otherwise the holiday shopping season would be cut too short, and they were trying to get out of the recession and the depression. So Roosevelt moved it, and the Republicans in Congress howled. They said, no, you can't do that. This is a tradition. They actually had two Thanksgivings that year, a Republican and a Democratic Thanksgiving. The Democratic one was actually called Franksgiving, in honor of Franklin D. Roosevelt. So we are quite able to argue just about anything in this country, and we always have. We'd like to think that holidays are a little bit, especially holidays like Christmas. More to the point, obviously, it comes up today, is that in recent years, and it started with George W. Bush, really, on Thanksgiving of 2003, making the holiday visit to the troops. I mean, this is a much more recent thing. Certainly, presidents have gone into the field to visit troops many times in many situations in the past. But this holiday one has become a recent tradition. It was remarked until today that the current president had not visited the troops at all, and certainly not at the holidays. And, of course, today the president has apparently gone to Iraq.
We're talking right now with author and historian Ken Davis, and we're looking at how presidents have celebrated holidays in the past.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how presidents spend their holidays? Is there a Washington Christmas or New Year's tradition you're curious about? Have you been to D.C. during the holiday season? And if so, what did you enjoy most about it? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Darrell Connor. Author and historian Ken Davis is here with us, and we're talking with him today about presidential holiday traditions and how presidents throughout time have spent this week between Christmas and New Year's.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. 1234. Is there a presidential holiday tradition you're curious about? Do you think it's important for the country to see how a president celebrates the holidays? And if so, what would you like to see? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Ann in Green Bay. Hello, Ann. Welcome to Central Time.
Hello. I think this is all very fascinating. So I'm wondering if you have written a book or if you would consider writing a book about the history of Christmas and all the presidents involved from that point on.
I have not considered a book about the presidents and Christmas. I have written a book called Don't Know Much About the American Presidents, which goes through every one of the 44 up until through Obama. It was published a couple of years ago. But their connections to Christmas is becomes a little bit more seasonal, except if there's an unusual one like this or a piece of trivia like Harrison's first tree. Just on presidents and holidays, much more important from the very beginning, particularly in the White House, was New Year's. John Adams was, of course, the first president in the White House in 1800. In December 1800, the White House was brand new. It wasn't even really finished. But he inaugurated what became an annual tradition of inviting the public in on New Year's Day. It's kind of interesting to think that for a very long time, more than a century, the public was invited basically to come to the White House, and the president would stand there and greet people for sometimes hours. And it's a kind of interesting idea to think of Adams or Thomas Jefferson, who continued the tradition in 1802, standing there in his suit and welcoming people to the White House. A very different picture than we have of presidents in marble.
Thanks for that call, Jane. And you mentioned New Year's. Now, a lot of people make New Year's resolutions. Ken, have we ever had a president tell us publicly what they were planning on doing in the new year that wasn't, you know, just political grandstanding?
Well, mostly it's political grandstanding. I can't think of a specific, New Year's type resolution, but usually resolutions from presidents are called campaign promises, and we know how often they can be kept or not. Look, when I think about, you know, this season, particularly at this time of year, and a president visiting the troops, I think back particularly for 1968, 50 years ago, Christmas seemed to be bringing some hopes and thoughts of a truce, and then the truce exploded into the Tet Offensive in February of 1968. So any of these holidays always brings a sort of mixed blessing with it. And we hope and wish that all the troops would be home soon, of course, and they are not. And we have to remember in this midst of this season of light and hope and peace and joy that there are men and women all over the world right now wearing the uniform who are putting their lives on the line for us.
A caller had phoned in earlier to ask about the celebration of Kwanzaa. Has that ever been discussed?
By a president, I believe that it's now semi-officially celebrated in the way that all holidays, in a sense, are celebrated at the White House. I'm sure that under the Obamas, it certainly got a little bit more attention than it's getting currently. But, Kwanzaa is still a fairly young holiday in mm-hmm. this country. It's only been emerging in the past decade or so in a bigger and some ways more commercial way. And I don't think that most people still honestly recognize what the traditions mean. I've written about it in one of my books, Don't Know Much About Mythology, that this is a holiday that recognizes many of the ancient traditions of Africa. And the interesting thing about it is it is a candle lighting ceremony at the heart of Kwanzaa. And so many of the ceremonies at this time of year involve light and candles. You think of Hanukkah, the miracle of the lights, the lighting of the candles. We think, of course, of Christmas as being a holiday of light. And there's a lot of that is tied into the fact that most of these celebrations relate somehow back to the solstice, which we just celebrated, which was very significant in the dating of Christmas, that in ancient cultures, in ancient civilizations, the fact that the days were going to start get longer and that the sun was coming back to life in a sense was, you know, the sense of a new year. And that's why so many of the traditions around this time of year are traditions that involve lighting candles, whether it's the Kwanzaa candles or the Yule log. All of them mean light is coming back into the world.
Ken, we have just a couple minutes left, and I wanted to ask, of all these presidential holiday celebrations and traditions, which is the one that you wish, boy, I wish I got an invitation to the White House for that one?
You know, I think probably being at the White House for Roosevelt and Churchill might have been an interesting moment. They had an extraordinary relationship. I mentioned that they do get together, and Churchill actually comes to the White House secretly in December of 1941. Of course, everything had to be done in secret at that time. Great Britain, of course, was at war already, and the United States had just entered the war. So Churchill arrives under cover of night, essentially. But the notion of Franklin D. Roosevelt and Winston Churchill sipping brandies around the Christmas tree would probably have been a really interesting one to sit in on.
We had a caller who is on hold, and because of time, we can't take it, but she had asked, how many presidents attend a religious ceremony during the holidays?
Well, traditionally, almost all of them have, and it's unusual for them not to, certainly in recent times. And, of course, until recent times, most presidents tended to go to the Episcopal Church very near the White House. That was always thought to be the church of presidents. Different presidents have celebrated and practiced their religions differently, of course, especially in recent years.
Well, Ken, thanks so much for joining us today. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you so much, and enjoy the next 11 or 12 days, depending on how you count them.
Kenneth Davis is a historian and the author of Don't Know Much About History and other books in the Don't Know Much About series. His latest book is More Deadly Than War, The Hidden History of the Spanish Flu and the First World War. He joined us today to talk about presidential holiday traditions.
Coming up after the news, the Cold War was a dark cloud hanging over much of the 20th century. We'll look at Wisconsin's role in that conflict. I'm Darrell Conner.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson.
And I'm Darrell Conner. Coming up, the government shutdown is in its fifth day and shows no sign of being resolved. We'll talk about what the ramifications could be as lawmakers and the president dig in their heels over funding a border wall in just a bit.
First, the Cold War might bring to mind the Kremlin, the Berlin Wall, or the Bay of Pigs crisis.
But there were sites right here in Wisconsin that were linked to that global conflict of the U.S. and its allies versus the Soviet Union and the countries under its influence. And some prominent players also hailed from the Badger State.
Chris Sturtevant is the author of Cold War Wisconsin. He's also a U.S. Air Force veteran and chairman of the Midwest chapter of the Cold War Museum in Washington, D.C. Chris, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's briefly recap what led to the Cold War. The U.S. and the Soviet Union were allies in World War II. What happened?
Well, it dissolved pretty quickly after that. A Milwaukee native named George Kennan was on the scene as one of the first ambassadors to the Soviet Union, and he noticed that there were people disappearing. Joseph Stalin would not receive him anymore. None of the ambassadors were giving him the respect he gained during the war, and that led him to actually write the long telegram and form the basis of the containment policy. So the Soviets, of course, had a lot of troops still in Eastern Europe. We evacuated that area. They were intent on continuing to force those governments to lay claim to Soviet rule, and in a sense to stop the carnage from the World War, from the second to two World Wars, from Germans driving west, or east rather. So things did dissolve really quickly after that.
And so George Kennan, as you said, was a key figure in how to deal with the Soviet Union. He was from Wisconsin. What did he propose as a way to contain the Soviet Union? What was at the core of that?
He wanted to publicly, I guess, the United States wanted to recognize that borders were where they were, the Soviets were where they were, but then he would go ahead in a clandestine way to support what was called Operation Rollback, and that was to recruit men of military age that had come as refugees after the Second World War, train them, and then go into those countries in a clandestine fashion to support popular uprisings, to support governments being toppled from the Soviet standpoint, was a very mixed bag. In most cases, failed spectacularly. It was actually part of the Marshall Plan. Something we don't hear about a lot is 5% of those funds actually went to unspecified funds like embassy upkeep, but they would in turn use it in Albanian currency or the Baltic states to support these efforts.
And so this was a philosophy, a plan that started soon after World War II. It was really very current and still being followed decades later.
Up until 9/11, I mean, you're talking into the 2000s, that was our policy. We were going to react. And lessons learned in Pearl Harbor, caught with our pants down, 9/11, caught with our pants down. We're not, our eyes really aren't on where the real enemy was for many, many years. And so we've had to kind of pivot, so to speak, over the last 15 years, 20 years, to the realities of the world.
So a real terror of communism and what it could mean if it spread was really key to the Cold War and how people thought about the Soviet Union, about its satellite countries. And few names are more closely associated with that than Wisconsin Senator Joe McCarthy. Tell us about his role.
Very famous, famously known as the being part of the Red Scare, the second Red Scare. We had a Red Scare back in 1919. But this is the more popular one that people would recognize in a living history sense and things that we learn about. McCarthy came on the heels of the House Un-American Activities Committee, which was more of the Richard Nixon era, going after Alger Hiss, Whitaker Chambers. So when McCarthy came to power, he then focused on communists in government and picked a very ripe time where China had fallen to the communists in 1949, and the Soviets had detonated their atomic bomb. Korea was being invaded, so it got a lot of push and support from the public, especially here in Wisconsin, to root out what they felt was a very real threat.
Let's hear a bit of an interview that Senator Joe McCarthy did on June 25th, 1952.
You see, if you have a committee, the power to subpoena investigators, you don't use the same tactics you use when you have no committee, no power to subpoena, where you've got to dig and root out the communists and the crooks and those who are bad for America.
Yes.
Where you have a committee, so you have the power of subpoena, you can get the records. And if we have a Republican president, we'll be able to get those records, I'm sure. It will be a less spectacular fight, but much more effective. You see, it's difficult when you're all alone with the entire power of this federal bureaucracy against you. Difficult to dig them out. Even at that, you see, we have exposed gotten out of government 11 of those I originally named. Some of them have been convicted, others before the grand jury, but all out of the government under the loyalty program.
So he really saw himself as a crusader, and this was a very personal thing. Where did this belief and this commitment come from for him?
I really think he truly meant it and believed it. I think he had a duty. He was a United States Marine. He was a World War II veteran. He had a very small town values here in Wisconsin. Believed that it was his duty to go after what he felt was being eaten up from the inside. Strangely, it sounds kind of like the deep state today. You know, there's a lot of parallels with that type of thinking. But McCarthy, certainly that internal drive to find these individuals that were responsible. Certainly, we didn't know until the Venona decrypt, until the 1990s, that some of these people certainly were communists in the government. But at that time, I had a lot of difficulty finding anybody to sign on to his way of doing things. And we know the rest of the story and what he happened with the alcoholism and then being censored from the Senate.
So he was very committed to, as he said, rooting out communists in the government. What kind of proof or lack thereof was he going on?
It would be the testimonies of other people. I mean, it's usually a he said, she said. Were you a member of the Communist Party at one time? And many of these people were. They were card carrying because they thought that was the future in the 1930s. We had Americans, Americans here from Wisconsin that thought this went to the Soviet Union, thought they were just going to get a job at Ford Motor Company, help build cities. They really believed these things until they found out about the Nazi aggression pact, or the Nazi-Soviet pact. So maybe a lot of these people had that communist membership, went to the communist meetings, had some infiltration or connection to working in the government. So that was the proof, so to speak, and that's what he went on.
And what turned the tide against him finally?
Well, it was the Army hearings. He brought up General Marshall, the Marshall Plan. He had some semblance of, yes, he was very accommodating to the Chinese. They were talking about General Marshall. He was in charge of the fort that's in New Jersey where the Rosenberg Ring had worked and operated. But the public wasn't ready to hear that. The public didn't want to believe that a war hero like General Marshall was behind and he was accommodating these Soviet interests. And so I think it turned the tide that way. And of course, the Democrats took power in 1955 and then were able to kind of tamp him down.
We're talking with Chris Sturdivant about his new book, Cold War Wisconsin. And Chris, Manitowoc, Wisconsin has a long history of ship and submarine building, and I'm guessing the Cold War period was no exception. How did Manitowoc contribute to the Cold War effort?
That area in general, I'll include Kewaunee and Manitowoc, but we'll go with Manitowoc first. That happened to be a site of a Sputnik 4 crash in 1961. And Sputnik, of course, was the first artificial satellite launched by a country, which was the Soviet Union. We were in a space race, clearly, in 1957. Soviets got up there first. It's a big 180 metal sphere. It was beeping back and forth to places on Earth where you could listen through shortwave radio. It really scared us because we couldn't hide anywhere militarily. We couldn't hide from the Soviets and the communist menace. Our response to the original Sputnik, of course, was the Vanguard project. The old footage, you can see it just falls right off the launch pad, blows up. The press has a field day saying it's Flopnik, Kaputnik. And that was until Wernher von Braun took over and got our first satellite up in the air in 1958. So Sputnik, in a general sense, really scared people. And then the rocket systems, of course, would be used by the Soviets to take Laika up into space with the dog. Yuri Gagarin would go up and be the first human to orbit the Earth. And then the fourth Sputnik would be tracked by amateur astronomers and moon watchers, so to speak, that would be looking for it to fall down. And they knew kind of within a window of 3 days when it would come. They just didn't know where. And it turned out Sputnik 4 crashes on a street in Manitowoc, Wisconsin, right in front of the Rahr West Museum. And you can still see today a ring that commemorates where it landed.
You have a great photo in the book of these two police officers standing in the middle of a street. And you wouldn't think to look down at their feet unless you look
down there.
And there they are standing there with this imprint. I mean, it obviously had quite a bit of velocity built up, this imprint of part of Sputnik.
And that was the kind of the comedy of the situation too. You've got a couple of beat officers early morning hours. They see something in the road. They think it's cardboard. They keep moving. Hour later or so, they're going back. They realize they got to get it out of the road. It's very hot. They start kicking it to the curb. A few hours go by. Oh, we heard that Sputnik may have crashed in the area.
Maybe we should go back and take a look at that thing.
And they ended up getting somebody who happened to have connections to the Milwaukee Journal or the Sentinel, whichever was operational at that time. There was a businessman up there. He took it to the Milwaukee Journal or Sentinel, and then it ended up back in these government agencies. They all chipped away at it. It's a 20-pound rock. When they found it, it's 14 by the time all of our alphabet agencies get to it, and all the science labs give it back to the Soviets, and that's definitely a good portion of the book that people would be interested in reading.
And Manitowoc as a submarine and shipbuilding area, how about that?
They were active, of course, through World War II. They had a number of the biggest example I can think of would be the small boats, the river boats in Vietnam. But, of course, there's quite a few more. The Kewaunee shipyard would be the USS Pueblo, and that is a ship that's 50 years later still inside North Korea. That was captured in 1968. The crew members, 82 of them, one of them died in the firefight, released 11 months later. They kept the ship. And I happened to go on that ship 3 years ago. I was on the USS Pueblo and got to visit and see firsthand what the horrors they went through. And then, of course, got the North Korean side of, you know, what happened and how wonderful they were treating these prisoners and so on and so forth. But so the USS Pueblo, again, an international incident still held as a trophy inside North Korea from Kewaunee, Wisconsin.
We're talking with Chris Sturtevant about his new book, Cold War Wisconsin.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you remember the Cold War at its height? What was it like living under that cloud of fear and dread? Were you or someone in your family in the military then? What was that like? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll continue the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Darrell Connor.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Right now, we're continuing the conversation with author Chris Sturtevant about his book, Cold War Wisconsin.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What did you learn about the Cold War in school? What did you hear from your parents at home? Is there a Cold War site near where you live? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
Now, Chris, a large part of the Cold War was being ready at any time for a potential attack by the Soviet Union, and that meant weapons able to take down incoming Soviet bombers. Tell us about the Nike missile sites in Wisconsin.
Those were placed around most communities, or large cities around the United States after World War II. We had 200, what we called Nike Ajax missiles. They were surface-to-air missiles that would be tracking incoming Soviet bombers, which would make their way over the North Pole as the shortest route to come destroy American cities, especially here in the Midwest. So Milwaukee had 8 of them. It was part of a larger ring of supersonic steel, if you would. It was part of the Milwaukee, Gary, Chicago ring, which had over 30 missile bases. The ones in Milwaukee, 8 of them at one time, the conventional warheads, they then shrunk down to 3 when they went nuclear, and that would have been in Waukesha, that would have been in Brown Deer, north of the city, and then the Milwaukee Summerfest grounds would have been the third site. There was one missile base, nuclear Nike base, that was in west of the city outside the Twin Cities as well. There was one located inside Wisconsin, just inside in the state line there, but most of those were part of the Minneapolis cluster. So this would be our surface-to-air defense. These would take place of the turret guns and that we think of during the Second World War.
So it seems like these are pretty high security, secret military installations, but you say that people around them had a pretty good idea of what was going on, maybe not details, but that there was something there.
Yeah, I mean, there were houses around the Nike site in Waukesha, for example. So there were those were residential areas, largely farm areas that the Army would come in and procure the land for and do these. They were basically cookie-cutter designs, 3 missile pits in one area that would house the missiles. And then about a mile or two as the crow flies away, they would have the fire control area, which would have where all the men would be stationed, as well as have these radar tracking systems. They would be tracking either the missile, the incoming bombers. Some could toggle back and forth, but there were several on the Waukesha site that I can give a little bit more details.
Let's go to the phones, and John in Chippewa Falls is up. Hi, John.
Hi. Well, I was talking to your screener. I think your guest answered my question. Anyway, it was about a site near Roberts, Wisconsin. I think it was a Nike site. And I visited it. It's currently some sort of storage area. It's not owned by the government anymore.
I don't know too much about that site itself. I visited in a lot of the Southeast sites, which have turned into places that just have storage. Some of those bases were in Waukesha. I'll speak about Waukesha because it's a good example. In 1970, under the SALT Treaty, a number of these Nike sites disappeared simply because of the upkeep and trying to keep them operational. They were obsolete because the Soviets had gone to intercontinental ballistic missiles. And then they were transferred to parklands for usage of parkland. In Waukesha, Donald Rumsfeld actually signed over the deed, and then Waukesha received it in 1972 with the intent of having parkland on there. But a lot of these sites followed suit with the same situation, but many would fall into private ownership hands. Some would be in just have like private property, private housing developments. You know, boats would be stored in these missile pits. The one in one of the sites in Muskego is a manufacturing plant. Mm. So even though the government says you have to do X with this, somehow locally they end up in these. A number of them ended up in private hands, but many of them are used for storage. Even the one in Menominee Falls right now is used as a park. That is a park, but that's used for a lot of storage as well. Mm.
John, thanks for that call. Let's go back to the phones, and Elaine in Colfax is up. Hi, Elaine.
Hi. I think your guest is maybe too kind about Senator Joseph McCarthy. He was ruthless, and there were accusations made against people that they were just outrageous lies or exaggerations. And people's lives were destroyed. People committed suicide. And he was just reckless with this information. He became more and more, I would say, unhinged or insane. And his alcoholism was a contributing factor.
Thanks for that call. I want to make sure that we have time to address that, Chris.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with any of that. Those are things that we do know about. I have 30 seconds to answer these questions. These are simply just highlighting McCarthy as the politician, the man. And I go over some of those things in the book as well.
Thanks for that call, Elaine. And Chris, in your research, what did you learn about how much the Cold War really permeated everyday life for the residents of Wisconsin?
I'd say many of them, it really depends on what area you lived in. You know, I've met people that, you know, as children in northern Wisconsin would go up on these viewing platforms or on the top of school buildings and get binoculars and be looking for Soviet aircraft. You'd have women auxiliary groups that would just take the volunteering time, the Boy Scouts, the Cub Scouts, they would just be sent up for hours on end looking for these Soviet aircraft. They would have the silhouettes. So this is the 1950s. People were certainly... they were certainly scared of nuclear war. We watched it. I watched it growing up in the 1980s, all the movies about Damnation Alley, The Day After, the movie about the which escaping my mind, Red Dawn, would be another one. So people watched this in public in a TV sense. So it permeated us in many, many different ways.
When I was preparing for our conversation, I looked on the Wisconsin Historical Society's website, and I found a photo of a Wisconsin family with its new fallout shelter that had just been delivered. And you can actually see that image at WPR.org. Was that a common feature in homes of the time?
I think there were some people that were jealous they didn't have. When I talked to some people, they thought the person down the road had a fallout shelter, so therefore they wanted one. Maybe it was kind of like the new color TV sets in the 60s. Like they wanted one. They wanted to feel safe. Whether or not they would have been active, actually something that would have kept people safe or for what period of time, who knows. But probably not, not a lot. Obviously, there was a cottage industry and nuclear fallout shelters, but I'm sure that wasn't every house, unlike Switzerland or some of these countries actually have where you have to buy a seat in a fallout shelter. But so not as, widespread as that.
Chris, a very short chapter in your book might be what stayed with me the most. It was about an event that took place in Mosinee, Wisconsin on May 1st, 1950. Tell us about the Day Under Communism.
That was organized by the American Legion. The American Legion had long been an advocate of taking on communism. Even in our, as an American Legion member, we have an oath that we say before that says to support and perpetuate 100% Americanism. So they knew the Red Scare even back from 1919. So 1950, northern Wisconsin, they wanted to demonstrate what a day under communism would be like. So they did this mock day on May 1st, of course, the workers' holiday. that they had soup kitchens going. They took all the books. They arrested the mayor, who ended up dying a few days later of a heart attack. The minister who died also like a week later, 10 days later, was really just absurd. But anyway, you know, it was just a way for people to react and respond on a local level, what they felt like was a real issue and was a real security threat. TASS came to, you know, the Life magazine came to cover this, and it was certainly a day that we kind of look back and think, what is going on there? But on the other hand, it was their response and what they could do to demonstrate exactly what it would be like to live under communism.
I wondered reading that whether it had any kind of a War of the Worlds effect where some people tuned in late kind of and thought it was really happening.
It could have. I think they were given some notice. I think they were given notice. And actually, the Communist Party of the United States, so some people, they were actually distributing flyers the night before. So it got a response even to the local people on the ground there.
Well, Chris, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Christopher Sturtevant is a children's librarian who lives in Milwaukee. His interest in the Cold War began while growing up during the 1980s, and he is the author of a new book called Cold War Wisconsin. And you can find out more about that at WPR.org. Once in a while, you might see a difference in how much rain or snow falls in one area as opposed to down the road, across town, or maybe in the next county over.
Usually that might be a fraction of an inch difference, and it's more often than not a gradual shift over the space in between.
But earlier this month, half of the town of Colfax in Dunn County got 6 inches of snow. The other half and all the areas around it got next to nothing.
It turns out that the local, and we mean very local, snow was a combination of steam from local factories and near perfect conditions to turn it into snow.
Those conditions were the right amount of temperature to make snow, saturation so the moisture didn't just stay in the clouds, and low winds so it stayed in place.
A meteorologist with the National Weather Service said that the 1 mile swath of snow was parked over that part of Colfax for about 7 hours.
You know, growing up in Chicago, we heard a lot about lake effect snow, but I've never heard of factory effect snow.
Not only is it possible, an area of Indiana had the same thing happen on the same night earlier this month.
That is just crazy. If you live near Colfax and saw the factory effect snow, let us know by emailing us at ideas@WPR.org. A photo would be even better.
You can read more about the Colfax snow over at WPR.org. Our reporter Rich Kramer has more info there about it.
This is Central Time.